though in a radiated shade of lime. Don held Father Story's head between his crooked fingers, while Harper clipped hunks of bloody hair away from the spot behind his ear where he had been struck. The scalp beneath was purplish black, like eggplant. In the waiting room, their voices rose again. The Beatles now. The sun was coming. The long, lonely winter was over. Father Story stiffened and began to kick his heels. "He's having a grand mal," she said. "He's going to choke on his tongue," said Don Lewiston. "Anatomically impossible." "We're losing him." Yes, Harper thought. If this wasn't a final convulsion, it was close to it. Foam dribbled from the corner of his mouth. His left hand grabbed fistfuls of the sheets, let them go, grabbed again. He couldn't do anything with the right hand. Harper was holding his right wrist, monitoring his erratic, racing pulse. The song in the next room rose to a high, sweet, perfect note, and Father Story's eyes sprang open again, and his irises were rings of gold light. His back had been arched right off the mattress, so only his head and heels touched, but now he relaxed onto his bedsheets. His heartbeat began to slow. Squiggles of dull red light pulsed in his dragon scale, faded, pulsed again. He almost seemed to smile, the corners of his mouth rising just slightly, and his eyelids sank shut. "He's out," Don said. "But God, it helped. They sang him out of the worst of it." "Yes, I think they did. Put the bid in for me, will you, Don? Are we doing this? He doesn't have much strength left. If it's not now, there won't be another chance later." She shaved the rest of the hair off the back of Father Story's head to reveal the outraged flesh. It was no good giving herself time to think. It wouldn't help to dwell on maybe killing him, or lobotomizing him, slipping and driving the drill in deep enough to throw curds of brain. Don stuck his hand in the nearly boiling water without any sign of distress. Harper thought those hands were just slightly more sensitive than a pair of canvas gloves, and brought up the dripping bit. He clicked it into a Black & Decker power drill straight from Home Depot and gave the trigger a squeeze. It whirred to life with a sound that made her think of egg beaters and cake frosting. He looked at the blackening bruise on Father Story's scalp and swallowed. "You aren't going to ask me," he began, then caught himself and swallowed again. "I don't know how many fish I've put an end to, gutted and cleaned, but a person, Tommy, I don't think I can..." "No, I won't ask you to do it. It better be me, Mr. Lewiston." "Course, you've done it before." It was not quite a question, the way he put it, and she didn't think he required an answer. She held out her hand for the drill. The bit steamed. "I will need you to hold his head. Do not let it move in any way while I'm operating, Mr. Lewiston," she said, in a tone of cold command that hardly seemed identifiable as her own voice. "Yes'm." He spidered his fingers over Father Story's head, lifting it off the pillow. She examined the drill, found the dial that controlled the power settings, and turned it up as far as it would go. She gave the trigger a test squeeze. It startled her, the bit spinning up to a chrome blur, the vibration shooting down her arm. "I wish we had better fackin' light," Don said. "I wish we had a better fackin' doctor," she said, and bent and located the tip of the drill 2 inches to one side of Father Story's right ear, where the bruise was ugliest. She pressed the trigger. The bit chewed up the thin layer of skin in an instant, turning it to what looked like flakes of wet-cooked oatmeal. The bone smoked and whined as the drill worked down into it. She applied pressure slowly, determinedly. Sweat sprang up on her face, but Don was occupied holding the head still, and she could not ask him to wipe her brow. A single drop of sweat caught in an eyelash, and when she blinked, the eye began to burn. Blood welled from the hole in the skull and raced up the grooves of the bit. She thought obscenely of a child sucking red Kool-Aid up through a crazy straw. Without opening his eyes, Father Story said, "Better, Harper. Thank you." Then he was silent, and he did not speak again for 2 months. Book 4, Marlborough Man. 1. From the Diary of Harold Cross, June 18th. The girls in this camp are a pack of lesbian bitches, and if they all burn tomorrow, I wouldn't give a smoky fart. The word from SF is they've got 2,500 people alive in the Presidio who have the scale, and none of them are burning. Fuck this bullshit. I'm going to make an announcement in church tomorrow. Someone needs to tell these ignoramuses you don't have to worship in the holy church of Carol Story's sacred pussy hairs to live. Any release of oxytocin will tell the scale it's found a safe host. If I hear one more round of Spirit in the Sky or Holly Holy, I'm gonna puke. We could shut down the spore just as easy with one big circle jerk. A giant communal circle jerk, and Carol's pretty little hand right on the rod. Her daddy can frig her while she frigs me. That's what she really wants anyway. I haven't written a new poem in days. I hate this place. 2. Harper read just the one page in Harold's notebook, picked at random, then flipped through some others. She glimpsed doodles of boobs and bush, saw some words in dark block lettering. Sluts, whores, bitches, cunts. Harper had never met him, but felt she understood Harold Cross pretty well. She thought a collection of Mr. Cross's poetry would probably go nicely alongside a copy of Desolation's Plough. She turned back to the entry from June 18th and let her gaze linger on that one sentence. Any release of oxytocin will tell the scale it's found a safe host. She folded the notebook shut, slapped it against her thigh, and put it in one of the drawers. Then, after a moment, took it out again. The drop ceiling was made of big white squares of particle board. She had to stand on a chair to reach them. Harper lifted one ceiling tile and pushed the notebook up and out of sight. Not as good as hiding it inside an anatomical model of the human head, but it would do for now. She could not have said who she was hiding it from. Perhaps it was only that Harold had been hiding it himself, which meant he thought there was someone who would take it away if he or she had a chance. As she was pushing the chair back where she found it, she noticed blood on her knuckles, staining the fingers of her right hand. Tom Story's blood. She washed it off in icy water, watched pink swirls chase one another down the drain in candy cane stripes. Father Story slept on his back, the top of his head bandaged in a cap of clean white gauze. The dusty windows above let in milky rays of sunshine. Like Father Story himself, the daylight seemed tired out, hardly there. But the sheet was tucked under his chin, not pulled over his face. He had lasted the night. That was no small triumph. Harper was woozy with exhaustion, but the baby wasn't going to let her sleep. The baby was hungry. What the baby wanted was a deep, warm, buttery bowl of cream of wheat, drowned in maple syrup. Food first, sleep after. As she walked over the snow along a path of wobbling pine boards, through knee-high mist, she tried to remember what she knew about oxytocin. It had a nickname, the cuddle hormone, because it was released when a mother held her baby, released in mother and child alike. Harper thought about crawling through that smoke-filled drainpipe and singing to the infant she hadn't seen yet, and how it had shut down the scale. Your brain gave you a fix of oxytocin when you hugged, when you received a round of applause, when you sang in harmony with someone, and the singing was good. Strong communal experiences produced it like nothing else. You could get a dose from a good experience on Twitter or Facebook, too. When lots of people retweeted something you said, or favorited a photo, they were throwing the switch for another squirt of oxytocin. Why not call it the social networking hormone, then? That was better than cuddle hormone, because... She couldn't remember. There was something else about oxytocin, something important, but it had been too long since she had done the reading. For some reason, though, when she shut her eyes, she was picturing soldiers in desert fatigues and jackboots, cradling M16s. Why that? Why did oxytocin also make her think of crosses burning in the Mississippi night? The cafeteria was padlocked from the outside, and there was plywood nailed up in the windows. The place looked shut for the winter. But Harper had helped out enough in the kitchen to know where the key was hidden, hanging on a nail under the steps. She let herself into the spacious, dusty dimness. The chairs and benches were all turned upside down on tables. The kitchen was gloomy, everything put away. Harper found a tray of biscuits in the oven, covered with saran wrap. She took a tub of peanut butter from one of the cupboards and was crossing the room to fetch a butter knife when she almost stepped through an open trap door into the cellar. A slanted wooden ladder led down into a darkness that smelled of earth and rodents. She was frowning at the open hole when she heard a curse from below, followed by a soft thud, as if someone had dropped a flour sack. A man groaned. Harper stuck half a biscuit in her mouth and started down. The basement was crowded with a lot of cheap steel shelving, plastic jugs of vegetable oil and sacks of flour packed onto them. Set into one wall was a walk-in freezer, the thick metal door open about half a foot and light shining out. She called, "Hello," but didn't manage much more than a croak, had a throat full of dry biscuit. Harper crept to the massive door and poked her head inside. The convicts were on tiptoes against the far wall. They were handcuffed together, the chain looped over a length of pipe located almost 7 feet off the floor, so they had to stand there, each with an arm raised, like students trying to get teachers' attention. She had seen one of the prisoners before, the big man with the queer yellow eyes, but the other one was new to her. The second man could have been as young as 30 or as old as 50, rangy and awkwardly built, with a high forehead that brought to mind Frankenstein's monster, and a close-cropped cap of black hair, threaded with strands of silver. Both men wore thick woolen socks and the school bus-colored jumpsuits. The man Harper had met the night before grinned to show pink teeth. His upper lip was split open in a nasty gash and still drooling blood. The room had a rank stink of meat gone bad. Pools of gore had dried on the concrete, beneath rusted chains that had once suspended sides of beef. Ben Patchett sat in a straight-backed wooden chair, his head between his knees. He looked like someone trying not to be sick. A battery-powered lamp sat on the floor next to a lumpy dish towel. "What's going on here?" Harper asked. Ben lifted his head and stared at her, as if he had never seen her before. "What are you doing here? You ought to be tucked into bed." "But here I am." She was surprised at the mixture of aloofness and calm she heard in her own voice. It was not a tone she used with friends, but the one she reserved for irksome patients. "These men are suffering from exposure. Hanging them from a pipe wouldn't be my recommended course of treatment." "Oh, Harp. Harper, you have no idea what..." This guy here," Ben said and gestured with his gun. Harper hadn't noticed until now he was holding it. "Me," said the prisoner with the bloody mouth. "Oh yeah, me. I might as well fess up. I got sick and tired of dangling from this fucking pipe while shithead here shouts at me. I let my bad mood get the better of me and tried to attack his gun with my face. It's a shame you had to interrupt us. I was just getting ready to assault his boot with my nuts." Ben glared. "I didn't do a thing to you wasn't self-defense." He looked at Harper. "He kicked me to the ground. Tried to stomp my head in, too." "Self-defense, huh? Is that why you brought the towel full of rocks down here? You anticipated you'd have to defend yourself with them, and your .38 wasn't good enough?" said the bleeding man. Ben blushed. Harper had never seen a grown man blush so hard. She sank to one knee, folded back a corner of the towel on the floor. It was full of white rocks. She looked up, but Ben wouldn't meet her eyes. She peered over at the man with the busted mouth. "What's your name?"
"Mazzuccelli. Mark Mazzuccelli. Lots of guys call me the Maz. Lady, no offense, but if I had known this was what you meant when you said you were going to rescue us, I think I would have said thanks, but no thanks. I was dying just fine where I was."
"I'm sorry. None of this should have happened." "You got that right, Harper," Ben said, starting with the moment this fella decided to bash in Father Story's head and run. "A couple of guys found him trying to boost one of our cars. Blood all over him."
"Old blood. Christ, it was old blood. Anyone could see it was old blood. Why would I attack this father of yours anyway? Dude just saved my life. What would I get out of killing him?
His boots, Ben said. The ones you had on when we caught you running. His boots and his coat.
The Maz looked at Harper with aggrieved, pleading eyes. This guy, this father of yours, he gave me his boots when he saw I didn't have any. Coat, too. He gave them to me because I couldn't feel my feet, what for the cold. Is that the kind of guy you pay back with a rock to the head? Look, I've been telling this dude. I told him. The Holy Father and I came back ahead of the other two boats. He was nothing but good to me. He gave me his boots and coat because he saw I couldn't stop shivering. When we got to shore, he led me into the woods. We walked, I don't know, a couple hundred feet. Then he pointed at the church steeple and said, stay on the path, and in another minute or two I'd come to the chapel and there would be people to help me. He said he wanted to go back and make sure everyone else got to shore okay. I offered to give him his boots back, but he wouldn't take them. And, all right, look, I don't know none of you. I saw the chapel, but I also saw a perfectly good Buick parked around behind it, and I thought, shit, maybe I ought to go someplace where I do know people. I didn't mean anything by it. I didn't know the car belonged to anyone.
That's right. You didn't know it belonged to anyone. And the world is just full of free cars. They're like picking daisies at the side of the road, Ben said.
The world is full of free cars now, said the Maz. On account of a person relinquishes ownership of the wheels after going up in fucking smoke. There's probably 1,000 cars in this state ain't no one ever gonna claim.
Harper stepped toward the convicts. Ben leaped up and caught her wrist.
Don't. I don't want you near him. Stay behind me.
This guy is in need of medical treatment. My arm, please, Mr. Patchett. He seemed almost to flinch from the formal use of his name. Or maybe he was flinching from her tone. Calm, patient, but impersonal, quietly in charge. He let go of her arm, and if there was unhappy surprise in his face, perhaps it was because he understood he was letting go of his control over the situation as well. He could argue with Harper, but not with Nurse Willows. He looked past her to the prisoners.
You touch her, either one of you. I won't be using the butt of the gun on you, understand?
Harper came close enough to the Maz to smell his breath, a metallic odor of fresh blood. She leaned in to inspect his pink teeth. You won't need stitches, she said, but I'd like to get a cold compress against your mouth. How are your feet?
Been a while since I could feel them. Gilbert is worse. Gil can hardly stand.
He gestured with his head toward the other convict, who had not spoken yet.
And my hands, the cuffs, I got no circulation.
We'll get those right off. Mr. Patchett?
No, they stay on.
You can cuff them to something else if you think it's necessary, but you can't keep them like this, in a stressed position.
That has to stop. Whatever you think they've done, it doesn't justify abuse.
I'll tell you about abuse, cried the Maz. Keeping us strung up here is the least of it. You ought to hear how I wound up with a busted mouth. See, I could take being locked up with my arm coming out of the socket, and I could take no food, nothing to drink, and no rest. What made me lose my composure is the feeling like maybe I need to have a crap. This one says he'd be glad to help me with that, soon as I start answering his questions the way he wants them answered. He said the next thing to come out of my mouth better be something good. I didn't want to disappoint him, so I spat in his fat top face. Then he smashes me one. He would have hit me again, but I put my knee in his stomach and dropped him on the floor, which just goes to show I can whip his ass with one hand cuffed behind my back. Literally.
Ben said, why don't you shut up before you give a handcuffed man another pistol whipping, Mr. Patchett? Harper asked quietly. Ben shot a startled, embarrassed glance at Harper, an expression that made her think of a sixth grader caught looking at a dirty picture.
Shoot, he whispered.
It was obvious he didn't want the convicts to hear him, but the acoustics of the bare metal room made a private conversation impossible.
Now, Harper, come on.
It wasn't anything like that. I cuffed him there because it was the easiest place, not to cause suffering.
the tower full of rocks. That was just to scare them. And this guy tried to stomp my head in, same as he stomped in Father Story's skull. I was lucky to get clear. I can't believe you'd take his word over mine. I have to think that's hormones talking. I don't care which of you is telling the truth, she said. It was an effort to keep the anger out of her voice. Hormones. My concern is medical. This man is injured and can't remain hung up like he is. Get him down. I'll let him down, but he can wear the cuffs right into the crapper. The Maz said, fine by me, long as you promise to wipe my ass when I'm finished. And I better warn you, brother, this one feels like it's going to be wet. That's not helpful, Harper said. Copy that. Sorry, ma'am. The Maz cast his gaze downward, but a smile teased the corners of his mouth. What about you? Harper asked, turning to the man who hadn't spoken. Gilbert, do you need to use the facilities?
No, thank you, ma'am. I'm fairly constipated. I've been buttoned up for several days now.
This was met by a moment of silence, and then Harper laughed. She couldn't help it. She could not even say why it was so funny. Gilbert, what's your last name?
Klein, but you can call me Gil. I don't need the bathroom, but I'd commit any number of crimes for a bite to eat.
Don't worry, said Renee Gilmanton. We won't let you go hungry, Mr. Klein. No felonies required.
Harper wheeled and saw Renee standing in the open locker door. Renee went on.
I don't know how you can maintain an appetite in here, though. Whew, it smells bad. Is this the best we can do for them?
Jesus, Ben muttered. First her, now you. I'm sorry the frickin' Hilton didn't have any rooms available for an attempted murderer and his accomplice. What the heck are you doing here? You ought to be asleep. No one should be out during the daytime. We have rules for a reason.
The girls wanted an update on Father's story, and when I checked the infirmary, Harper wasn't there. I figured the cafeteria was the next best bet.
Anything I can do to help?
No, Ben said.
Yes, Harper told her. This man needs a cold compress for his face, a cup of hot tea, and a visit to the bathroom, although probably not in that order. Both of them ought to have breakfast. And you're right, this is a filthy place for them. There's two unused beds in the infirmary. We ought to—
Out of the question, Ben said. They stay here.
Both of them?
Right.
I was meaning to get to that. You said Mr. Mazzuccelli assaulted Father Story. I'm not clear why Mr. Klein is also locked up.
Because they're in it together, these two. They already partnered up to break out of one place.
But I take it Mr. Klein was nowhere near the scene of the attack on Father Story.
Ben's eyes were dull, expressionless. No. He was on the boat with me. Father Story and Mazzuccelli arrived back at camp first. Then Allie and Mike. Klein and me got lost paddling around in the mist, and for a while I couldn't find the bay.
Finally, I spotted a flashing light and we rowed toward it. It was Allie, signaling us from the beach. She stayed on the beach to be sure we found our way back, while Michael went on ahead. We had barely pulled the canoe onto shore when we heard Mike screaming for help. We proceeded to the scene.
Harper noted the way Ben had unconsciously begun to tell the story, as if he were giving a deposition to a hostile lawyer.
And found Mike sitting in the snow with Father Story, and blood everywhere. Mike said someone had killed him, but when Allie checked his pulse, we determined he was still with us. Michael carried Father Story into camp, which was where we found a few men holding Mr. Mazzuccelli. Allie observed that Mazzuccelli was wearing Father Story's boots and coat. After that, the situation turned hostile. Both these men are lucky they weren't killed.
That still doesn't explain why Mr. Klein is being treated as a threat, Renee said.
Gilbert said,
when things turned ugly, my partner shouted for help. I gave it.
He broke three fingers in Frank Pendergrass's right hand, Ben said, and punched Jamie close in the throat so hard I thought he crushed her windpipe. Jamie is 19, by the way, barely more than a kid.
A kid who was holding a broken bottle, Gilbert said, almost apologetically.
I'll need to see them both, Harper said. I should have seen Mr. Pendergrass before now.
He didn't want to distract you from Father's story, Ben said. Don bandaged him up pretty good with some rags we had laying around.
God damn it, she said.
The injuries she couldn't adequately treat because she didn't have the supplies kept piling up. Subdural hematoma, facial contusion, advanced exposure, John sprains and smashed ribs and dislocations, now a badly shattered hand. She had iodine, band-aids, and Alka-Seltzer. She had sealed the hole in Father Story's skull with cork and candle wax, like a doctor from the 17th century. It was the 17th century out here in the woods. Ben went on. Whatever Klein did and why ever he did it, let's be clear. We all knew who bashed in Father Story's head, Klein as well as us. He chose his side. He chose not to watch his friend be killed by a lynch mob, Renee said. That's understandable. Ben looked at Gilbert Klein and said, What I understand is he ought to pick better friends. His buddy nearly killed a man. Klein knew it. He could have stayed out of it. He chose to commit some life-endangering assaults of his own. You want to dispute any part of this story, Klein? You go on and speak right up. No, sir, Gilbert Klein said, but he was looking at Renee. That's how it happened. The Maz is the only reason I didn't die in the lockup, and I never would have made it through the smoke and down to the canoes if not for him. I could barely move my legs. He just about carried me. I felt obliged not to stand back and watch him get killed. And did you think he bashed in Father Story's head? Ben asked. Klein looked to Mazzuccelli and back to Ben. His face was a calm, composed blank. It didn't cross my mind it mattered one way or another. I owed him. Harper had, until now, been concerned with injury and exposure. She had not paused to think about what it meant if Mark Mazzuccelli had really done it, really taken a rock to the back of Father Story's head, all for a pair of boots. The rock. Was the weapon on Mr. Mazzuccelli when you discovered him trying to get away? Harper asked. No, the Maz said, 'cause it's all bullshit. I never had no weapon. We haven't found what he used to crush Father Story's head in, Ben said, his voice stiff. Not so far. We may turn it up yet. So what you have is an assault with no witnesses, no weapon, and a man who professes his innocence even after you hung him up in a stress position and struck him with your gun. It wasn't even a little light. Harper held up a hand. You're not in court and I'm not a judge. I don't have any authority to go casting judgments. And neither do you. As far as I'm concerned, you don't have proof of anything. And until you do, these men ought to be treated as well as anyone in camp. Renee continued, And without any evidence of wrongdoing, I'm curious how long you plan to keep them locked up and on what basis. There needs to be some kind of fair process. They have a right to a defense. They have a right to rights. I'd love to take that dump now, said the Maz, but no one listened to him. I don't know if you heard, Renee, Ben said. But the Constitution went up in flames, along with the rest of Washington, D.C. The people in this camp would like very much not to wind up as cinders as well, Miss ACLU. I used to donate to them every year, in fact, Renee said. Never mind that, though. I'm trying to make a point. We don't just need to decide whether or not this man tried to kill Tom Story. We need to decide how we decide, and who does the deciding. And if Mr. Mazzuccelli here is found guilty, we have to make a choice as a community about what to do with him, about what we can live with. That's the hard part. I don't think it's that hard. I think this community has already made a choice. You would know that if you'd been there when they started throwing rocks. I don't know what you were doing all night, but you missed all kinds of fun. Maybe I spent my night hiding in the woods, Renee said. Waiting for a chance to kill Father Story. Ben stared, his mouth open and his brow furrowed, as if she had just posed a particularly irritating riddle. He shook his head. You shouldn't make cracks. You don't have any idea what Carol and Allie and that crowd would do to you if they thought... His voice trailed off, and then he started again with a hard smile on his face. Thing about you, Renee, you're a good intentions person. With your tea and your books and your story sessions for the kids, you're just as harmless as they come. And like most really harmless people, You don't have the faintest idea what other people are capable of doing.
But don't you see, Ben? That's precisely my point. We don't know what other people are capable of doing. None of us does. Who could say for certain Father Story wasn't surprised by someone in this camp who wants to do him harm? For all you know, I might have had a reason to want him dead. And it might have been me waiting in the trees with a rock. It could have been anyone. And without certainty, we can't publicly execute a man. We ought not to even lock him up indefinitely.
That's where you're wrong, Renee. That's where you talk yourself into a corner. See, Mark Mazzucchelli here, he had a motive and he had an opportunity. Which is bad. But what's worse, I can't think of one other person in this whole camp would wish harm on the sweet old man who took us all in, who gave us shelter, and who taught us how to protect ourselves from the dragon scale. It's that simple. I can't think of one reason why anyone else would want Father Story dead.
Which was when Harper remembered what Tom Story had told her in the canoe.
I'm going to have to send someone away, he had said. Someone who has done unforgivable things.
Oh, Harper said, I can think of a reason.
3. From the Diary of Harold Cross. June 19th. The shitters. The loathsome, ignorant shitters. June 19th. Later. Officer Catshit took my phone, and before he switched it off, he wiped it right in front of my eyes. Every text, every mail, every note. They didn't understand anything. They didn't even try to understand. As soon as I told them I had been communicating with people on the outside, they went into hysterics. If they had the Jim Jones Kool-Aid on hand, they all would have been lined up for a cup. Now that I've calmed down, I wonder if I should have anticipated this. The most unique characteristic of the fungus is the way it bonds with the mind. Dr. Solzhenitsyn in Novosibirsk has shown the spore is dendritic in nature and compatible with the architecture of the brain. Oxytocin tells Draco Incendia Trichophyton it has found a safe environment. The fungus, in turn, stimulates flock behavior to preserve its own well-being, the same groupthink that makes a crowd of sparrows turn on a dime. The scale is so overpowering, it can temporarily erase even fundamental notions of personal identity. Other people's ideas seem like your own. Other people's needs seem more important than yours, etc. We really are living in the zombie apocalypse. It's just the zombies are us. All this makes sense, given the nature of oxytocin, which brings comfort to those who participate in tribal behavior. I'm not part of this stupid, Christing tribe, which is why I'm smoking all the time and getting no chemical benefit from their idiotic daily sing-alongs. It also explains why everyone was so eager to turn in their cell phones. Yes, Fuckface took all of them, not just mine. The scale has them all addicted to social approval. I would love to know why the firemen can steer the scale instead of being steered by it. No one is more aloof than him. I would kill to know how he can set fire to parts of himself and not be hurt. I'm not the only one who wants to know what he knows, either. I was down on the beach 3 days ago and heard them over on their island yelling at each other. Whatever he knows, he won't tell Sarah's story, and boy, oh boy, is she pissed. If she tears him a new asshole, it's tough shit for Mr. Rookwood. This infirmary is all out of asshole patches, and everything else. 4. She swatted her thigh with the notebook and looked out the window. Goose-down flakes of snow floated about. Couldn't decide if they wanted to fall or rise. Camp was a snow globe, and some godchild had given it a shake. Harper had been awake for 15 minutes, and still wasn't sure if it was morning or afternoon. The light was diffuse and gray, as if the whole world were hidden under a bedsheet. She sat on the edge of Father Story's cot. Every once in a while he would draw a sudden, startled-sounding breath, as if he had just read something terrible in the newspaper. The obituary of a friend, maybe. His own obituary. One thing that had been true in the summer of Harold Cross was even more true now.
The infirmary was out of asshole patches and everything else. She had disinfected Father Story's trepanation with a splash of port and had treated John Rookwood's mauled arm with a weak dose of good intentions. She wasn't sure good intentions always paved the road to hell, but they for sure weren't the highest standard of medical care. She stood on the chair and reached up to put Harold's notebook behind the ceiling panel. Some little movement or gesture at the edge of her vision caught her attention. She looked around and discovered she and Father Story had company that morning. Nick was in the cot closest to the door, sheets pulled to his chest. His hair was a pretty black tousle. He gazed at her as if he had forgotten how to blink. He must have crept in while she was asleep and quietly settled into the first empty bed. She pushed the notebook up out of sight, deciding to act as if this were a perfectly normal thing to do. When the ceiling tile was back in place, she climbed down off the chair and stood at the foot of Nick's cot. Harper moved her hands carefully, using what he had taught her so far to ask why he was here. He reached for the notepad and pen he carried with him everywhere he went and wrote, "My stomach hurts. Allie walked me over. She had to come to the infirmary anyway because she's stationed here today." Harper sat beside him on the cot, took his notepad and wrote, "Have you been vomiting? Diarrhea?" He shook his head. She suspected anxiety for Father Story, not food poisoning. "What do you mean, Allie is stationed here?" Harper wrote and passed him his pad and pen. "She's in the other room," Nick scrawled. Harper raised her shoulders in an exaggerated shrug, hands out, palms turned up. "Why?" "Allie's here for protection. Aunt Carol wants to make sure Granddad is safe." "What did you just stick in the ceiling?" Before she could formulate a reply, he added, "I promise if you tell me, I won't say a word." She had to smile at that. Of course he wouldn't. "Just some notes I'm keeping," she said, which was true, even if it was leaving out a detail or two. "Notes on what?" "If you don't ask about that," she wrote, "I won't ask if you really have a stomach ache." He smacked the heel of his hand into his forehead, a gesture he must have picked up from television. She didn't judge. Harper sometimes felt she spent half her life playing Julie Andrews in the movie version of her life. The problem with role models is they teach you roles. Harper used her finger spelling to say, "S-L-E-E-P." He nodded and said, "You too, right?" Speaking in silence, hands moving precisely through the air, as if he were adjusting the gears of an invisible machine. "I go," she said with her own less fluent hands. "Be soon back." "Be careful," said Nick's hands. Allie was in the waiting room, curled on the couch, not asleep, not reading, just lying there with the knuckles of one hand pressed to her lips. She blinked and glanced up. For a moment her eyes were unfocused, and she seemed to look upon Harper without recognition. "Nick says you've been stationed here." "Looks like. You've got Ben and Aunt Carol thinking someone in camp might be out to kill Granddad. I think that's nuts. Everyone knows it was that guy, the Maz. But I don't call the shots." "And Ben does?" "He's just doing what Aunt Carol wants. And she wants Granddad safe. You can't blame her. Someone did try to kill him. Aunt Carol wants you to stay here from now on, too. So there's always medical staff on hand, in case he has a seizure or whatever." "Am I going to start eating here, too?" Harper was joking, but Allie said, "Yeah. She was really upset when she heard you wandered off yesterday to get something to snack on and left him all alone. His heart could have stopped, or someone could have walked in and put a pillow over his face." "I can't stay here, not full time. As a matter of fact, I have to step out right now. John's pretty banged up. I want to head over to his island and get a compression bandage and a brace on him." Harper was not carrying either item, but was counting on Allie not to notice, and she didn't. "Can't," Allie said. "Even if you were allowed to leave the infirmary, it's the middle of the day. No one goes out during the day." "What do you mean, even if I was allowed?" "Is that from Carol? Who put her in charge?"
"We did."
"Who?"
"All of us. We voted. You weren't there. You were sleeping. We gathered in the church and we sang for Father Story. We sang to everyone we've ever lost to show us what to do. I swear I could hear them singing with us. There were only 140 people in church, but it was like 1,000 people singing all at once. Allie's bare arms pebbled with goosebumps at the memory of it. She hugged herself. It felt like being rescued from every bad feeling you ever had. I think it was just what we needed. Afterward, we settled down and held hands and talked. We talked about the things we were still glad for. We said thanks, like you do before a meal, and we made plans. That was when we voted to give Ben final authority on all security matters. And we voted to make Aunt Carol head of the chapel services and daily planning, which is what Father Story used to do. At first she didn't want to. She said she couldn't take on any more work. She said she needed to look after her dad. So we took another vote, and everyone voted for Carol all over again. So then she said we were making a mistake. She said she wasn't strong like her father, that he was better than her in every way, kinder and more thoughtful and patient. But we took a third vote, and she won that one, too, unanimously. It was funny. It was so funny. Even Carol laughed. She was kind of crying laughing. Harper thought of something in Harold's diary. The fungus stimulates flock behavior to preserve its own well-being, the same groupthink that makes a crowd of sparrows turn on a dime. But she didn't like where that thought led her, and she pushed it aside. Allie said, I don't think I ought to let you go. The last time I was on duty in the infirmary and didn't do my job, a kid got killed. She gave Harper a crooked smile that had no real happiness in it. What are you going to do to me if I walk out? You going to tackle a pregnant woman? No, Allie said. I'd probably just shoot you in the leg or something. She was smirking when she said it, and Harper almost laughed. Then she saw the Winchester leaning in one corner of the room. Why in God's name do you have a gun? She cried. Mr. Patchett decided the lookouts on guard should have rifles, Allie said. He said we should have passed out the guns a long time ago. If a cremation crew turns up, a little bit of shooting would get a lot more people killed is what it would do. None of you ought to be carrying rifles. Allie, some of the lookouts are all of 14 years old. Harper did not mention that Allie herself was not yet 17. The idea of the kids stalking around in the snow with loaded guns agitated her, made her want to give Ben Patchett a hard poke in his soft gut. It's only the older kids, Allie said, but for the first time she sounded defensive. I'm going, Harper said. No, don't. Please. Let's wait until dark and we can talk to Carol. Going out in the daytime is pretty much the most important rule in camp. It'll be dark soon. In this snow, it might as well be dark already. We pulled the boards up. You'd leave tracks. Not for long. It's snowing now. My tracks will fill in. Allie, would you let anyone tell you that you couldn't go? She had her there. Allie stared into a blue dimness silted with a billion diamond flecks of flying snow. The muscles at the corners of her jaw bunched up. Shit, she said at last. This is so stupid. I shouldn't. Thank you, Harper said. You need to be back in 2 hours or less. If you're not back in 2 hours, I'm going to feed you to the wolves. If I'm not back in 2 hours, you ought to get Don Lewiston anyway, just to check on Father Story's condition, see how he's doing. Allie glared at Harper. You have no idea how fucked this is. All us lookouts met after chapel. Ben Patchett said too many people have been putting themselves ahead of the well-being of camp, doing what they like. He said we need to make some examples out of people who can't follow our rules. We all voted. We agreed. We made a pact. Mr. Patchett can worry about the well-being of the camp, Harper said. I need to worry about the well-being of my patients. If he finds out, you tell him you tried to make me stay and you couldn't stop me. But he's not going to find out, because I'll be back before you know it. Go if you're going to go then, before I change my mind. Harper had her hand on the latch when Allie spoke again. I'm glad he likes you, Allie said. John is the loneliest person I know. She glanced back, but Allie wasn't looking at her anymore. She was flopped on her side, curling up on the couch once more. Harper thought the gentle blessings of children were often as unprovoked, unexpected,
and uncalled for as their cruelties. Camp Wyndham that winter was neither Hogwarts nor the island in Lord of the Flies after all, but a place of wandering, damaged orphans, kids who were willing to forego eating lunch so there was enough food for others. "I'll be back soon," Harper said, and when she said it, she believed it. But she did not return until long, long after dark fell, and by then, everything in camp had changed again. 5. The trees were ghosts of themselves in a smoke world of low clouds and falling snow. The dying afternoon smelled like pine cones burned in an ashtray. Harper meant every word of what she had promised Allie, that she was going to paddle over to the fireman's island, check his condition, and come back. She had left out the part about needing to go home to get compression bandages and a brace first, because the infirmary cupboard was all but bare. If Allie knew about that, she might have knocked her down and sat on her chest to keep her from going. She thought she might have a good poke around while she was home, see what else she could find that might be of use in Camp Wyndham, shampoos and books and socks. But when she got there, she discovered there wasn't as much to poke around in as she expected. She stopped at the edge of the woods, looking at what was left of her house with a feeling of shock so intense it approached awe. The side of the house facing the street had collapsed in on itself, the entire face swept away. Some great force had dragged the living room couch out into the yard and tossed it all the way to the edge of the driveway. Snow had mounded up on it, but Harper could still see the armrests. She guessed there was some more junk scattered across the lawn, but they were just lumps under the snow now. It looked like her house had been brushed by a tornado. She caught her breath and thought back to the night she left. She remembered a rending crack, so loud it shook the ground. Jacob had climbed into his freightliner and sideswiped the snowplow through the front of the house, dropped the roof in on what remained of their life together. Papers hung impaled from bare tree branches, scattered all along the edge of the woods. Harper pulled one down, a page from Desolation's plow. She read the first words. "Despair is no more than a synonym for consciousness, and demolition much the same as art," and let the fretful breeze tug the sheet out of her hand. It flapped away in the wind. Harper was so dazed, she almost forgot her plan and drifted out of the woods into the yard, leaving footprints all the way. But a car shushed past on the road, making a sound like an admonition to be silent, and reminded her to take care. She worked her way around the house to the south side of the ruin, where trees crowded close to the wall. A single red spruce hung a wet and glistening limb over the snow, reaching out to almost touch the vinyl siding. In a doctor's office of the mind, Nurse Willows, dressed in crisp medical whites, addressed Miss Willows, 6 months pregnant, sitting on the exam room table in a paper gown. "Oh yes, Miss Willows, I hope you will continue at the gym. It's important to stay healthy and active for as long as you can do so comfortably." Harper wrapped both hands around the branch, which was about 4 feet off the ground, inhaled deeply, and swung. She pendulumed across 2 yards of snow and reached down with her feet, and her toes found purchase in the icy gravel that bordered the house. She felt herself sliding back, was in danger of letting go and falling onto the frozen ground. She pedaled her feet at the loose rock, lunged, and let go of the branch. Harper fell against the wall, the rubbery lump of her belly bouncing gently off the siding. A little extra cushioning, it turned out, came in handy. She followed the narrow strip of gravel under the eaves around to the back of the house. The door into the basement was locked, but she did the combination jiggle-kick-shoulder-thump Jacob had taught her, and it opened up. She stepped into cold, stale air and pulled the door shut behind her. When they first moved in, they had remodeled the basement into an entertaining area, complete with bar and pool table, but it had never really stopped feeling like a cellar. Cheap, nubby carpet over cement floor, an odor of copper pipes and cobwebs. The collapse of the house above had led to much more radical redecorating. The fridge had dropped through the ceiling from the kitchen and toppled over onto its side.
The door hung open to show the condiments and salad dressings still nestled on the shelves. Wires dangled from the hole overhead. The pool table remained curiously undamaged in the center of the room. Harper had never learned how to play. Jacob, on the other hand, could not only run the table, but could balance a pool stick on a single finger and a plate on the end of the cue, another of his circus tricks. In retrospect, Harper supposed it did not pay to be too impressed with the man just because he could ride a unicycle. The camping supplies, tent, portable gas stove, oil lamp, were in the bank of cupboards against the back wall, and the first aid kit was packed in there with them. They had always liked backpacking. That was one thing she could look back on with fondness. They had both been crazy for sex in the woods. She had badly twisted an ankle when they were hiking in Montana, and Jacob had cheerfully carried her piggyback the last mile to the Granite Park Chalet. She had bought the first aid kit as soon as they got home, to be prepared for the next time one of them banged themselves up on a hike. But there was no next time, and after a few more years, there was no more hiking. The kit was better stocked than she remembered. It contained a stack of compression bandages, alongside ice packs and burn cream. But the real prize was shoved in next to the first aid supplies, and was the thing she had wanted most, her central reason for returning. A black elastic elbow brace, left over from 2 years before. Jacob had wiped out playing her in racquetball, and sprained his arm. They hadn't ever played after that. Jacob claimed the elbow still sometimes gave him a twinge, and said he didn't want to risk straining it again. But she had sometimes imagined he quit racquetball for far less understandable reasons. She had been shutting him out at the time he smashed his elbow into the wall. It wasn't so much that he hated losing. It was just that he hated losing to her. In their relationship, he was the coordinated one, and Harper was comically, adorably clumsy. He took it personally when she stepped out of character. She sorted around in the other cupboards and found a long box of Galois, shoved back on a high shelf, the cellophane peeled off and a few packs missing. Jacob had announced a year before, a million years before, that he had quit smoking cold turkey and felt sorry for people who didn't have the willpower to do the same. For once she was glad he was full of shit. As in any guerrilla economy, there was no underestimating the value of cigarettes these days. People had been wrong to hoard gold for the collapse of civilization. They would have been better served to stock up on camels. She went around behind the bar to see what they had for booze. Facing the counter, at her back, was a smoked glass door that opened into an empty hole where they had planned to put a stereo someday. Hadn't got around to it. Jacob had insisted on a Bang & Olufsen system that cost almost $10,000, and any plan to save for it had remained strictly hypothetical. She crouched for a look in the liquor cabinet and found a bottle of 30-year-old Balvenie that would taste like smoke and fill a person with angel's breath. There was also a bottle of cheap, banana-flavored rum that would be just fine if you wanted to get sick. Harper wondered what John Rookwood might tell her about Dragon Scale after a Balvenie on the rocks or three. She was still hunched down behind the bar when someone wiggle-kick-shoulder-thumped the basement door. "Grayson!" cried a hoarse, wheezing, loud, somehow familiar voice, and Harper choked on a cry. Didn't reply, didn't move. Hunched there frozen, waiting for whoever it was to tell her what to do. "Grayson!" the man shouted again, and Harper realized he was not outside shouting in, but inside shouting out. "It worked! We're in!" "I wanted to get that lock fixed. I was always worried someone was going to come in and steal the good whiskey and rape my wife," Jacob said. "I had very protective feelings toward the whiskey." His voice was a knife, a thing she felt in the abdomen as much as heard. Harper opened the tinted glass door into that hole where they had planned to stack a stereo. It was as deep as the footwell under a large office desk, nothing in it except some dangling cables. She climbed in with the first aid kit and the brace and the cigarettes, squeezing herself tight around the beach ball of her stomach. 3 days ago she had climbed through a smoke-filled drainpipe with this stomach. She didn't think she would be able to do it now. She eased the glass door shut behind her. "Right," said the first man. in a voice that made Harper think of a fat guy wheezing over a plate of scrambled eggs and a double order of bacon.
I get that. You don't want some reprehensible scumbag drinking up your stash of expensive booze. Unfortunately for you, you led me right to it.
He laughed, a sound like someone squeezing a broken toy accordion, a kind of musical gasp.
Why don't you head upstairs and have a poke around? See if she's been here. We'll secure the basement. And by secure, I mean drink your whiskey, play pool, and look for dirty home movies. She hasn't been here. I come out here now and then, you know, keeping an eye on the place. I figured she'd come back sooner or later, for her books or her favorite pajamas or her old Pooh Bear. I swear, sometimes I felt like a child molester sleeping with her. We had to watch Mary Poppins every Christmas, as soon as we were done opening presents. Christ, said the one with the fat man's voice, and at last Harper knew why he was familiar to her. She had heard the Marlboro Man often enough on the radio. And you waited until she got sick to try and kill her?
He bawled with laughter at his own joke. Another man, not Jacob, confirmed the cleverness of this bon mot with a shrill titter.
You can see no one has been here from the snow. No footprints, Jacob said. You're probably right, but we'll look anyway, just to be sure. You know about me and the secret broadcast? I ever told you about that? The radio in my head? No. When I was 12, I could put my hand on a silent radio and close my eyes, and I could hear the DJ introducing Walk This Way. I could hear him in my mind, like I was the antenna, pulling the signal right into my brain. I'd tell my buddies, I'll bet every one of you that if we turn on the radio, it'll be playing Walk This Way. Everyone would pitch in a buck. I'd turn on the radio, and Steven Tyler would be right there, bragging about how his girl is a real good bleeder. Or like, when I was old enough to drive, I'd be sitting in my friend's crap Trans Am, the car turned off, waiting for him to come out of a corner store with a six-pack of Schlitz. And suddenly I'd know Mo Vaughn had just slugged a home run. I'd know. My pal would come out, turn the keys, and all of Fenway would be cheering for the big hit, Joe Castiglione shouting about how far Mo smashed it. For a long time, I thought maybe I was picking signals up on my filling somehow. But ever since the plague day started, I've been hearing new signals. Sometimes I'll hear my own voice on the secret broadcast, reading a news report. I'll hear myself talking about how a dozen burners were discovered hiding in the basement of Portsmouth Library, and they were shot dead by a heroic cremation crew. So I'll get the gang together and we'll go down there, and sure enough, burners hiding in the cellar. Remember that, Marty? Remember the time I said we ought to go down to Portsmouth Library and check things out? We killed every one of those motherfuckers. It all went down just exactly the way I heard it on my telepathic news report. That's true, cried the third man, his voice piping and obsequious. You knew they were going to be there, Marlboro Man. You knew before any of us. So that's why we had to come over here today? You had a psychic tickle that my wife might have come home? Jacob asked. He didn't sound like a believer. Maybe. Maybe I heard a little voice that said, why not run by and have a look? Then again, maybe I just remembered you saying you had some good scotch and I wanted a taste. Why don't you have a peek around and we'll find out which it is? Sure, Jacob said. Check behind the bar. See what's left. A door opened across the room. Sheetrock and shattered lathes tumbled out with a crash. Jacob cursed. The one named Marty made hyena sounds that approximated laughter. Jacob clambered away over sliding, tumbling, clattering debris. Someone approached the bar. Harper could dimly see a man in snow pants through the tinted glass. A skinny guy with a bushy afro of reddish, wiry hair bent over, opened the liquor cabinet, pulled out the Balvenie. Is this stuff good? Fucking A. Hand it over. Let me have a look.
Silence.
God damn, this cost more than I used to make in a week. You think his wife is half as nice as his pool table and his whiskey? Said the Marlboro man. Don't matter, Marty said. She's got the skeeve. You ain't gonna fuck that. True. Speaking of skeeve, See if there are some glasses. I don't want your backwash in the bottle.
The skinny guy bent and dug around and came up with tumblers.
You want music? Based on his pool table and his whiskey, I bet he's got a sweet fucking sound system.